Peace, this is Common, and you're on the tightrope. Love.
Back to the goddess, some say I'm too modest because I'm the hardest on this path to progress. There's been carnage, regardless, this is a harvest for the world to harness. Elders' dreams, creators' promise, being free is like paying homage. I've been on that peace, Black Dalai Lama. My college was between Stony and Cottage. The knowledge I got.
Well, hello everyone, I'm Trisha Rose. Welcome to the Tightrope. We're thrilled to have you with us. This is where we engage in love and justice infused dialogue while we hang out on this very treacherous thing called the tightrope. Sometimes love and justice isn't easy, but we do our best and try to stay on balance as much as possible. But always helping us think carefully, always helping us keep love and justice in the front is Dr. Cornel West, my amazing co-host, dear friend, and spiritual guide for many, many people. Dr. West, how are you doing today?
I'm telling you, I'm feeling on fire and fortified just being in conversation with you and knowing it looked like we're going to make it through this grim year and come out stronger than ever.
Wow, goodness. See, that's why we need you, because I'm thinking I'm just going to just hang on and like just inch to 2020 is ending, and you got us looking fortified. So how do you do that, Cornel? What's on your mind and what are you inspired by right now? And what insight can you offer us to have the spirit that you're describing?
Well, it's just like you know, Sister Trisha, that we got so many thick love injections in terms of mama, daddy, grandmama, granddaddy. The long tradition has gone into shaping and molding who and what we are. Mm. So when you got a fire that the world can't dampen, you got a vision that the world can't distort, then you're fortified no matter what the situation or the context is.
Mm. That's true. That's true. And, you know, part of what really matters, and I've learned this from really spending so much fantastic time with you this year, the silver lining of 2020 is what this time with you is all about. But what I've been really noticing is that, you know, the more the world wants us to pay attention to the wrong things, the more important it is for us to remember where the nourishment comes from, where the fortification comes from, which is what you're really emphasizing here. Go ahead, tell us a little bit more about that.
Absolutely. It just means we got to keep our points of reference in the right place, though. We fighting against white supremacy, but we fighting because we love Black people. We love people who are getting crushed. When predatory capitalism coming at us, we're not just reacting, it's we love working people.
Right.
Patriarchy coming at us, we ain't parasites on patriarchy. We love the sisters, no matter what color. Same is true with homophobia, same is true with transphobia. So as long as you keep your points of reference in place, then you're not just reactive. And that's precisely why the artists, and especially the musicians, and brother, we're going to be talking about very soon, become so crucial, because they are the vanguard of the species. They provide the visions, the inspiration, the insight, and the sources of courage and fortitude. That's the only way you can sustain yourself and be a long distance runner from womb to tomb. We're not talking about a lifestyle in terms of fitting into a status quo. We're talking about a way of being in the world. That's what the great artists have always done, of all colors, but especially Black folk, given all the hatred, given all the trauma and the terror coming at us, that we depend on them for their vision, their example, their courage, their longevity, their quality, and most importantly, their integrity. We're not talking about purity. We're not talking about perfection, but consistency, constancy. That's what we love about the brother we're going to be talking about.
Yes, in fact,
this
let's just.
This is a marathon brother, constant and consistent and still young. Still young.
Keep going. Go ahead. Introduce him, Cornel, man. You on a roll. I don't want to interrupt bro. Keep going.
It's hard to find somebody like this, brother. I know he come out of Chicago. Everybody born in Chicago got a jump start in life with Curtis Mayfield and Eugene Record and the Dale, the Mighty Dales and Kanye and the others. But this particular brother take us from resurrection to a beautiful revolution. Can you borrow a dollar on the one hand and still bear witness over almost 30 years later with a smile on his face, still looking young, the hardest working artist in show business, be it the music, be it TV, be it the film, be it political activism, be it the fun, and most importantly, he still got his style. He still got his style. I was listening to his father's rap last night. He said, now, son, I know from 47th Street to 87th Street, your hood was my hood, but always keep the love thing in place. Mm. See, that's Lonnie. That's Pops.
Yeah.
He puts a smile on Pops' face because the love thing is still in place in 2020, and that was 1994. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about Common.
Common, we are. I mean, how could we not be thrilled to see you after that introduction, bruh? We are so happy to have you here. Thank you for joining us on the Tightrope.
First of all, I give thanks to God. Thanks to the ancestors. That introduction, Dr. West, that love right there, man. I mean, that'll carry me through the rest of the year, to 2021 and beyond, man. I mean, thank you for honoring my father and giving him respect. Trisha, thank you all for just letting me be a part of this conversation. And man, I'm here smiling because I believe in love, and I believe in the love that my father talked about and the love that you all share. And like you said, when we talk about the tightrope, is like love. It's not always just hugs and kisses. Sometimes that's just like, it's a fist, and it's a power fist up, and sometimes it's the arm blocking someone from coming in your space. And sometimes it's feeding the children, you know, breakfast in the mornings like the Black Panthers. And sometimes it's telling each other what we don't want to hear. But that's love. And that's the love that I want to be a part of. And I love just being on this show. So thank you, guys.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing. So tell us about Let Love Have the Last Word. I mean, to me, this is such a powerful title. What was the genesis of it? Especially this year, right? I mean, this is what? A year filled with so much hate in so many ways and so much pain and suffering. How did you come to this idea, and what do you mean? Just to let our audience get a sense of what you have in mind.
I was slated to write a book. I've written a book in 2011, and I was, you know, figuring out what I really wanted to say. And you know what? I had this conversation with my daughter. She had brought up, first of all, she called me late one night, and I was supposed to get up very early to do this, start my first day of filming this movie. So when she called me, she was talking. I can hear she'd been drinking. She was in college and she'd been drinking. And I was like, you know, listen a little bit. And then I was like, okay, I'm gonna call you tomorrow because I gotta get up early. And she called me back like 3 minutes later and was like really confronting me. She was like, yo, you didn't do this for me. You didn't do that. And I'm like, wait, what? You know, so I said, let's talk about this. So when we got, you know, in person, face to face, she told me a lot of things that she felt that I had failed her in and that I didn't do for her. And I was hurt. And initially I really wanted to just like defend myself and just say, hey, what about these things? But as the conversation began to go on and I realized this was her perspective, I felt like the only way that I could truly love her is to listen to her at this moment, just to humble myself and listen and not try to fix it, but listen. So I listened to her, we discussed it. And though I didn't agree with everything, we just continued the discussion. And then we eventually, you know, just started, our relationship started building even greater from there. And what I learned and how this relates to the book is I started understanding that as much as I was doing my best to be the best person I could be, I needed to learn how to exercise and practice love in higher ways. And sometimes that meant just sitting down, being silent and listening. Sometimes that meant the person I really want to punch, I gotta take a chance to just stop and try to understand them. Sometimes that meant being easier on myself or even more challenging to myself. But I had to understand that love was like a really continuous process. It wasn't like, oh, I just say I love you and then that's it. No, it has to be action to it. And it has to be action that's present, because that presence is what allows me to really show that I love you, because at times you may be different. You may not want to receive the love in that way at that time. You know, so I really just started to look at that and say, man, how can I put these thoughts in a book and my experiences that I've been through, but also not make it a biography or autobiography, because I did something of that nature already in the first book. How could I just tell these stories that deal with love and the way I love has shaped me and how I look at it? And I came across the Dr. King quote that at one point says something about love and something about it being the last word. And I remember looking at the Bible and it said, let love and faithfulness do this. So I came up with the title, Let Love Have the Last Word, as a way of just saying, I'm going to apply love to everything I do, and I'm gonna apply it as a living organism, as a way of action, as a thing of action. That's the whole gist of the book, and that's I wanted to bring it out to, I wanted our Black men to know too that, man, we go through different things, and it's okay to open up and be open-hearted and to say, man, I've been hurt, I've been through some things, but I wanna be better. And I wanted, you know, Black people to feel like, okay, it's okay to go through to different sources to be better, to know that we've been through trauma and have inherited trauma, but we can access and say that the things that we wanna heal and work on those things, but it, you know, it takes a certain vulnerability and an openness to do it.
Mm. Absolutely. Mm. Wow. That's courage. That's the courage though, brother. I mean, you got some moments in that text when you start going into some relationships. I say, I know exactly what you're talking about, my brother. Playing this thing out. And the benchmark of moral and spiritual greatness is humility, vulnerability, and along with tenacity. You see, so that the vulnerability is not going to disempower you. It's going to make you stronger.
Mm-hmm. And that's what I found. That's what I found was that the more I opened up, because I talked about some heavy things that went on, like from me being molested as a child to like what I talked about with my daughter, and just dealing with therapy and different things. Man, the more I just was able to, because, you know, after I released the book, it was like conversations. I was having conversations about it. And the more I did, first of all, not only was I liberating myself, but it was like couples coming up to me at the book signing saying, a woman would be like, thank you. You, man, you made my husband decide to talk about these things or feel like it's okay to talk about these things. And this book has changed his way of thinking or, you know, just opened that person up. And, you know, several women have spoke to me about in their lives how it affected them. And my point is that, you know, you tell your stories and you tell the things and you open yourself up and be vulnerable, and it's liberating for you and it's strengthening for you. Like, I feel like I'm myself more than ever. Absolutely. But also, you understand that in telling those stories, you also giving somebody else access to or open up and somebody else a chance and inspiration to do it. And you're a part of their healing, and it's a powerful thing.
Yeah, that's
exactly right.
That's critical. That's critical. And, you know, it's so hard when you are in an intimate relationship, whether it's, you know, romantic one or just a close community or a father-daughter relationship like you described, to hear someone else's pain when it's attached to something they think you've done or you might have done. That's the moment that, you know, is so transformational in your book, because for me, because when you think about the world as we know it right now, the conflict is about not being able to hear the other person's pain. Right. It's exactly that incapacity that is keeping so much hostility between men and women, between Black and white. And we can go around the room about all the various connections that are being frayed because of that incapacity. So that moment that you described, that ability to say, you know, the way you put it here, to listen and not defend ourselves, right? To have the strength to know that you can hear what someone else is saying. It don't mean you are going to come to pieces, but it can literally feel like that.
Yeah.
And so to show particularly men who I think have been sold a terrible bill of goods about vulnerability as the equivalent of weakness. And that has been a violent, detrimental, horrible piece of so-called masculinity that everybody needs to toss right on out.
That aspect right there could help heal so much of the violence that we have going on in our communities. It could help heal some of the relationships that we have with not only our partners, but, you know, shoot, our parents and beyond. And I think having that strength to be able to be humble enough to say, hey, because this is strength and humility, because man and people by nature, you want to defend yourself. You're like, you know, and if you want, you know, a lot of times, especially if you feel like you think you're right, you know, you think like some of the things that my daughter was saying at the time, I was like, man, like it just didn't, I was surprised she even thought that way. But man, how could I tell her how to feel is what I was saying. And really, how could I negate if that, those are her feelings and that's the way she's seen things and that's what she felt growing up in her experiences and this is what she thinks right now. Me defending myself and me being right is not worth me not listening to her, you know, and not hearing her out and understanding. And actually a lot more healing took place in me listening and finding an understanding. And I work on it more and more, like, because, you know, in conversations, we quick to like start talking soon. So I try to listen and allow people to finish their sentences. I don't, you know, sometimes in this Zoom era and all that, it ain't as easy. I be cutting people off, but it's like, you know, overall, it's like I'm working on that because I think it's very important to do what you said, Trisha, to hear what other people have to say. And you don't have to agree with it. You don't have to come to an agreement, but hearing them means something. A lot of the cries that you hear from young Black men and what's going on is like, those are cries that are like, hear us, see us, man, feel us. Like, and, you know, acknowledgement is one of the wounds and one of the things that people in power and people who have certain authority, which we all have authority, we all given authority on this planet. Let me be clear that I'm a person and believe in the Bible. So we given dominion and authority, but people who like know that they have authority and know that people need that acknowledgement can give it and can heal a lot of things. And I think that's where a lot of that let love have the last word has come from. And a lot of my growth is coming about through that.
Yeah.
No, I think one of the distinctive features of your corpus, and you opening for NWA and Big Daddy King, and then all the way through Kanye, and now with Kendrick and the others, with Rhapsody and all the young folk too, is that there is this acknowledgement that if we're gonna have a beautiful revolution, it's got to go all the way down. Yeah. I mean, the sister from Detroit has a line where she talks about the smile itself is part of the revolution.
Yeah.
You remember that moment?
Yes. Ooh,
she hits that thing.
She hits
the nail on the head. And see, Sister Trisha's got this dialectic between joy and justice. Yeah. See, if you got, joy is one of the fruits of the revolutionary love. If you talk about love and you ain't getting no joy, you just getting a little pleasure, you got to check yourself, right?
It's
a Keith Sweat moment. Something just ain't right.
And I'm so glad you brought up that point because like one of the things that inspired a beautiful revolution was I saw this quote that Asada Shakur had when she was talking about revolution is like treating your partner well. Revolution is like looking in the mirror, loving yourself. Revolution is beautiful. I mean, what she said, revolution has beauty. Revolution is love. And even I sat on the stage with Dr. Angela Davis before and she was like, man, it was love in that revolution. That's love what we were doing. It just made me recognize that the revolution is love. Like it is love. And like, it's that love that we're talking about. And it does have a beauty to it and it has a joy to it. I was looking at the murder of Fred Hampton, the documentary, and I saw them feeding the kids breakfast. And I'm like, man, that's joy. Like, how can you say that that's not good? These are revolutionaries. They saying we are feeding our children. That's a beautiful thing, man. And, right. and like people think of it like it gotta be just a revolt with guns and these things and that ain't what the embodiment and what the core of what a beautiful revolution is about.
Exactly right.
And you say that on another track, the name of which I don't remember right now, but you basically say, you know, you love when we play basketball and you love when we, you know, write a rhyme, but you don't love us, right, when you handcuff our hands. You don't love us when we're not basically performing certain gifts. And that's really important, because that's not the joy. That's that, and that's not the full love. That's not the breakfast. That's not the serving breakfast kind of love.
Nah, right? That ain't that. That ain't that,
that. People mistake that. They think that fame and, oh, I appreciate Black art and I appreciate, you know, Black rappers. I appreciate dance and I appreciate artistry. But no, you have to appreciate the whole soul, all the suffering, all the pain, all the mistakes, all the rage. If you don't love that, then you're not talking about the right kind of love. You're talking about your own self. You're talking about love that's good for you, not love that's good for other people.
Exactly. And love, and love is not, and love is not like that. Love is naturally a giver. God created us so that we could love. Like, he wanted to have something strong to love, something that was like him to love. And that's what we, like, we created in the image of the creator to love, right? So just loving everything that's already, like, gonna benefit you is that's not the ways of the creator. The creator loves all, right? And we are operating in the ways of the creator. And loving all, that's something that's not only necessary, but it's something that, like, it definitely, like, when I talked about it on the song, Falling is what you bringing up.
Oh, thank you. Sorry.
Once upon a time, there was a Black man.
They loved him when he shot ball. They loved him when he ran. They loved him when he rapped. They loved him when he danced. But really didn't love him when he was out with his fam. Couldn't love him in the hood or selling CDs. And couldn't love her when she was in the house sleep. I'm wondering if it's love, if it's really love at all. Because in that type of love, we fall.
That song, Falling, I'm talking about that. Like, when you say about, yo, loving all, loving everybody, it's like, no, you don't just love LeBron James. You gotta love Eric Garner too. Like, you gotta love Trayvon Martin too. Like, we one in the same. You know, you gotta love Sandra Bland and Breonna Taylor and Rekia Boyd. You gotta love, we all one in the same. And it's like, you gotta love these people that are incarcerated too, even when it's hard. You know, I just had situations where, I mean, I go into prisons and do work with people who are incarcerated, women and men. I just had a situation where a close friend of mine lost his nephew to some 17-year-old kids. So it's a fight for me to say, oh man, they gotta be loved, but they do at some point. They will. But, you know, and that doesn't mean we don't go through the journey of what the emotions are. And some of that love is gonna be correction. It's gonna have to happen. And that's necessary. But my point is, it's not just about loving those that's popular or those that can do for you.
Right.
Absolutely. Black love itself is a form of criminality in a white supremacist society. So that, I mean, when John Brown loved Black people as a vanilla brother, to die for Black people, from Douglas say, I live for the slave, he died for the slave. That's Frederick Douglass. When John Brown died for Black people, he was saying that the only way you can really, truly, deeply, intensely love a people who's so hated is to be willing to pay an ultimate price. Now, everybody ain't got to do that, but that's a sign of it, you see.
Yeah.
And so the question becomes, well, if we're taking that love seriously, we right back with Jesus into running out the money changers again, you can't help but have a revolutionary and subversive consequence. Now, it's not just a spectacle, so it's not going to be a matter of just acting and posing and posturing. It's going to be a matter of following through. But I mean, the love that you receive from Dr. Hines and Brother Lynn, that's subversive. You see, it has a cumulative subversive effect. You see, yes. I mean, they didn't have to go out and protest every Friday or Thursday, show people they're concerned about Black people. No, they love and they stayed. They bore witness in that way, and generates these kinds of effects and consequences. And yet, you know, the white supremacy still remains very, very thick and strong. And therefore, that's why we got to pass the tradition on. And that's exactly what you've been able to do in your work, be it music, be it film, be it your activism and so forth. And that's a beautiful thing, man.
And you know, I want to acknowledge something that you brought up that also, like, even to add on, like, the way our communities can truly love, like, it was my mother and my father. I didn't even grow up with my father, but he still, you know, I felt his love. I felt his energy and his wisdom and his truth, and I felt it. And then I got to get closer with him as time went on. But my stepfather was there you know, also just providing for me. My next door neighbors was like,
the neighborhood.
The aunt, my aunt, you know, like my aunts and my uncles took me to the drive-in and would take me to basketball, like was assistant coach for my team. That's extending towards people that's just like, not just looking out for those that is your immediate family or something. That's expressing love to your community, or, you know, a stepfather taking on a young man and saying, man, I'm going to help shape you too and give what I know, everything good or bad, I'm going to give you what I know and then help shape you in the way that I know best. You know, I felt that I was receiving that from love.
And there's so little emphasis in our culture for understanding the depth of this kinship in Black communities and the power of it and how much duress it operates under. And yet so many connections are made, developed, and so much care is given. It's not just some revolutionaries with the breakfast. It's who's there every day, all the time. Right. Yeah. It's not for the cameras. It's who's there every day, all the time, no matter what. Who's taking, you know, three cousins and an uncle and a nephew in the middle of the night to another town to get, some early wake up AAU game and, you know, who's late to work because, you know, all of that. I mean, it's all in that texture. That's what we see when we see people who've been loved. It's not that they've been showered with uncritical affirmation, but they've been invested in. And they've been invested in because they matter. And then when they show that value, right, that is almost more frustrating to a white supremacy attitude than anything, because it means I have something you actually cannot take away from me.
Yeah.
Hey, Tightrope community. As some of you know from our Patreon channel, we love to read books and to be in readerly community. And so we want to make sure that you're aware that Common has a new memoir called Let Love Have the Last Word, and it's available through Audible.
Yeah, you know, Sister Tricia, we were so blessed to have Brother Common on the Tightrope and for him to talk about love and allowing love to have the last word. It reminds us of the caravan of love of the Isley Brothers. It reminds us of Coltrane's Love Supreme. Sits at the very center of the Black freedom fighting legacy.
That is so true. I couldn't agree more. I mean, we always think of the fight being against something, but when love is driving it, it's really fighting for something. And Common quotes Dr. King at the beginning of this book, this new memoir, and he says this following from Martin Luther King: "We can no longer afford to worship the God of hate or bow before the altar of retaliation. As Arnold Toynbee says, love is the ultimate force that makes for the saving choice of life and good against the damning choice of death and evil. Therefore, the first hope in our inventory must be the hope that love is going to have the last word."
Boy, you bring together a vanilla brother like Toynbee with a chocolate brother like Martin Luther King Jr. Love is the key that opens the door to ultimate reality. Ooh, that's powerful stuff.
You know, whenever I hear King and whoever he chooses, it's a good day. But there was also Common's exploration was how to connect this transformative power of love in the arts, because the arts are such an important place where we imagine our better selves. And even when our realities fall so painfully short, art can be so transcending and allow you to feel a kind of love and openness that is harder to get to when you're just dealing with the reality of the world that we have right now.
Yeah, that's so true. And because art at its highest level always authorizes an alternative reality to the present nightmarish realities, that art can also authorize realities that are worse. There's dystopian forms of art that accent the hatred, that accent the grimness, that accent the contempt and the envy as well. And so art, like any other human phenomena, can cut both ways. And of course, Brother Common is one of the grand artists who's aware of this in ways in which so many of us are not.
Well, you put a spin on that, Cornell. I mean, that's an entirely new episode of the Tightrope we're going to have, because you're right. I mean, we do romanticize art. Oh, it's freeing. It's an opportunity. It's, you see new things. Sometimes you can see better the worst of things through through art. Sometimes the art is brilliant, even as it's doing work that can destroy our sense of hope and possibility. I think we might have to take a note and do that. But before we go design that episode, we are just going to remind our listeners to visit audible.com/thetightropepod or text the tightrope pod to 500-500 if you'd like to get started on Audible today. And there you'll receive a free download using our show code. In the meantime, let's jump back on the tightrope and keep on keeping on.
Keep on keeping on.
Hey there, all you tightrope walkers. So this week's Office Hours is a special edition because for the very first time ever, we invited our guest to stay on through the Office Hours segment. Common, in this episode, plays the role of the questioner or the student, and he throws a couple of good questions to Cornell and myself. We had a really, really good time talking with him in Office Hours. So we think you'll enjoy it too, and we hope this is a creative way to bring 2020 to a blessed close. Now, come 2021, we have exciting news because Office Hours is going to be moving to Patreon. And so members of our Patreon community will have access to all of our Office Hours episodes and also all kinds of other exclusive materials and behind the scenes stuff that we have going on at the Tightrope that doesn't always make the episodes. So join our Patreon community if you haven't already. Go to patreon.com/thetightropepod, patreon.com/thetightropepod, and join up and hang out in Office Hours with us over there. We're really looking forward to seeing you there. But until then, we got to finish 2020, the year that will never end. But this is an exciting moment to jump onto the rope with us and hang out with Common in our Office Hours. Have a great holiday season, and we'll see you in the new year.
I got to ask Dr. West, what do you think is the thing where, like, when we uplift our people, we uplift the Black community, why is the white man and white people so offended by that? Like, I'm speaking in general. I know every white person is not offended when Black people are being uplifted, but what's the, like, when we show Black love and we show that pride in who we are, what do you think offends the white supremacist so much, or the white person so much?
You know what, that's a profound question. I know Trisha got her deep insight on this too, but I think it has to do with the fact though, brother, that the very notion of a self-loving, free Black woman or man constitutes a kind of threat to any white supremacist order, because it means that they refuse to fit in. They refuse to be well adjusted to their injustice. And once somebody is that free, because you can't have radical love without freedom. You can't have radical freedom without love. So the love and the freedom go hand in hand. So when we talk about love warrior, we're talking about freedom fighter.
Right.
You see what I mean? Because that's what you're doing. You're shattering any forms of psychic and spiritual bondage. And by being a self-loving, self-respecting Black person, you are refusing the white normative gaze. You are refusing the white standards that's supposed to define you. You are calling into question any white-centered definitions of reality. And because they've been so used to defining the reality, and we got to fit in, and we say, no, Charlie Parker's playing on this side of town the way he wants to play. And if you want to come, you come over on his terms.
And if
Miles Davis is there, he might turn his back on you anyway, but he's still gonna blow. So there's a certain freedom there that's connected to a love that for the white mainstream appears like it's indifferent. That's why they thought Malcolm was some embodiment of hate. Now you see, you gotta be pretty twisted to think that Malcolm is loving Black people so intensely, and if you can't see the love, then you think everything's about you.
Yeah.
You see what I mean?
Right.
Trish, what you think?
I mean, that Cornell always renders me speechless. But the thing I would say in addition is that the key to white supremacy, you know, we think about the hateful component, but the what I call the everyday liberal form of white supremacy, requires that Black people, or asks, it doesn't require because we trying to stop it, but it asks us to be comfortable with our subordination, to be comfortable with our mistreatment, to accept it. And so the reason some whites think that we're somehow being hateful when we're loving Black people is that their own conception of their value hinges on us accepting this lower sense of self. So their sense of self is attached to the kind of sense of self they want Black people to have. Because you can't have an elevated self unless you're pushing somebody down. So yes, so it's not only our side of town and what we're doing, it's also their expectation of what we should do with that space. So, you know, when we were talking earlier about, you know, light and energy and all the love being poured into you, I was thinking, you know, that's what's kind of behind the obsession with reckless eyeballing. Think about that for a minute with Emmett Till and the like, right? It's that just the gaze to actually look someone in the eye from a place of confidence and just simply gaze directly at someone is a threat that expresses the challenge to white supremacy in terms of what expectations Black people are supposed to have for themselves. So that's why there's a lot of anxiety, because we need to say Blue Lives Matter because we want to deny what it really means to be Black in the face of a police state. And so they're asking us to accept that, to accept that this situation is reasonable. As soon as we don't, we look like we're somehow causing trouble.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Trisha just laid out.
I know.
But how would you answer your profound question, my brother?
I think it's definitely a thing of a fear that the people who have been in power and people who are thinking, I ain't even just gonna say only white supremacists, because it's not that, because sometimes it's every day.
Absolutely.
White folks that just don't want to see Black people, like, if when we say we celebrate Black, like Black Lives Matter, what, how does that offend anybody? That's not saying like your life don't matter either, but we just saying like Black, or if we say Black power, that shouldn't take away from your power. Black people should have power. You know, brown right. people.
Yeah, but their power depends on you not having no power. That's the point.
Right. But I think obviously it's coming from, yeah, exactly.
That's the little secret they don't want to talk about.
Yeah, simple. That just spell it out right there. And that comes from, that is fear. That is fear that if with Black people in power, then I'm gonna lose my position. That's what they're thinking. Or seeing Black people get rights and get jobs then I ain't gonna have jobs. I think some of that is just fear. Some of it is accumulative hatred passed down, where it's like kind of ingrained in the way of thinking and the DNA of some people who think like, man, these people are subordinate to me. These people are not really truly on my level. Like somewhere in their minds, they feel that. Not everyone, but some of them do. And some of it comes from lack of experience with Black culture and Black people, and not being around it to just humanize. Okay, this is a human being just like me.
Yeah.
You know, my second question to y'all, is it our duty to lead them to that place?
Woo. Common's coming strong today, Cornell.
Yeah, you ain't lying, but Common always coming strong.
I know. I just don't get this lovely opportunity. I'm gonna have to get his email or something, his phone number, these questions. This is heavy.
But it is our duty to, what sounded like a soda. That's what we said when we went to jail in Ferguson. It is our duty to love, bear witness, tell the truth, pursue justice, embrace joy, and never allow anybody to steal the fire inside of our souls. Now, if vanilla brothers and sisters wanna come, it's a beautiful thing. We ain't never excluded nobody.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? We ain't never excluded nobody. Sly Stone had white folk in his band. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Every white band could come on and imitate James and go and do their thing. They sounded good. We embrace it. Eminem, come on, Eminem from Detroit. Dr. Dre got you. You got your own genius. Common got his genius. You vanilla, he chocolate. We part of a chocolate art form. Come on in, Eminem. You see what I mean?
Yes.
So we, as long as we true to ourselves and they want to come, Charlie Parker's waiting for him in the club.
Yeah, exactly.
He ain't gonna do it on their terms.
But what Common's asking, though, Cornell, in addition to that absolute truth that you just spit, is that in what way are we supposed to educate whites about race so that we can get to a racially just place? In other words, what imagine the people who are not coming to hear Charlie Parker, right?
Right.
What do we do and what is our responsibility? And more importantly, can we ever really work to make that change? I mean, I'll take a stab at that first, but I want to pass the mic back to you, both of you, about that. But I mean, to me, first you have to begin where Cornell began, which is here's the space that this group of people has created. And we welcome in all people who are willing to respect us, be on our terms, and be fair and honest and open and true. Okay, that I'm with. At the same time, I would argue that Black freedom in the West will require a large number of non-Black people for it to be achieved and maintained. It cannot be simply won off the backs of Black struggle. It's just not.
True. But when we bear witness, though, it's always one that allows our identity to be rooted in a moral and spiritual integrity produces a universal solidarity.
Exactly.
With poor white folk, we stand with dollars and Indians.
Exactly.
We stand
exactly.
with Ethiopians, we stand with Nigerians, we stand with Guatemalans. It cuts across the board. Jews, Catholics, all folk who are concerned about truth and justice.
Right.
Let them come.
Right. But we also have to go get some of them. This is what I'm saying. I heard in Common's point. We got to go get some of them and knock on the door, and just like we canvass for votes, and be like, you are under a misunderstanding. Because you think about all the public conversations we have about race, who are they for, right? They're for Black folk, but they're also for people who need to be uneducated about the racism they think is normal. They need to be re-educated. They need to be transformed and encouraged. Now, it's not our job. That's where I agree with Cornell. We have this other job that he articulated. But I would argue that it's a legitimate and reasonable thing to do, because I think people can be transformed and they need to be canvassed, right? Door to door sometimes, as a metaphor. So, I mean, to me, I think that's going to be important because racism, sexism, homophobia, we're in a machinery that is always producing that all day long. Unless we're going to work against it all the time in some place, we can't do it all day, every day. But as long as we're going to do it some of the time, then we have a chance to stop that machinery, but it's going to be going on regardless. So that's the piece I was adding to the puzzle, Cornell.
Oh, yeah.
I wasn't challenging what you were saying.
Yeah.
What do you think, though? Are you not
a door-to-door kind of brother?
But, you know, let's think about Common. Let's think Common, you know, so you're in a meeting, right? You're in a meeting in Hollywood. Cornell ain't going door-to-door. I'm still laughing. I'm sorry. No, but so, you know, say you get a script. Common gets a script and it's like silly in terms of its racism. And I'm certain people have probably given him lines to say that were ridiculous, that he looked at and thought, I ain't saying this. You know, what kind of foolery is this? Now, he can just go make a Black film with Black folk. That would be the equivalent of Charlie Parker, and invite in the white people who are ready to play with Charlie. Or he can try to figure out how to explain to this person that this is some nonsense. See, that, so to me, that's two pieces of the puzzle.
Oh, yeah, but no, you can explain without going door to door, though.
Well, but there is...
You're just going to explain. You're going to explain it to him.
Yes, I know, but there is a door-to-door dimension of this. Yeah, all right, Cornell, we're going to have to keep on this one because when you're... Well, look, but if your livelihood partially depends on developing contracts and relationships in these industries, same thing's true of academia, where you... Not you, Cornell, because we ain't all you. Some of us have to have mere mortal-like jobs. So, you know, you might have to go and explain why they misunderstand Black studies or why they misunderstand hip-hop.
No, we
you might
do
have
that.
To go, and some of that might be canvassing, right? That's where you draw the line. Okay. Okay. All right. You've started a whole debate.
He went from shaking his head, to like, hold up. That's where the line got drawn.
I'm learning and listening now.
I want to speak to this because for me, you know, it's times I feel like it's, I feel like, and y'all both said it's not our duty, but at times I feel like it's our duty. Like, I used to always hear the term the poor righteous teachers, like, we've been given a certain amount of wisdom, experience, and children of God, no greater than any other nationality, but our experiences and what we have, I feel like it's our duty to God to go find the lost and to teach them, you know, and to spread that type of strength and love. And then there's times where I'm like, man, how do, you know, like, do I need to do that? Like, what am I supposed to do? Like, and I just don't feel like doing it. And I've been around people who like, man, they ain't our duty to do that. They've done all this damage. But I feel like if we don't take those steps, I almost feel like it's like teaching a child. Like, you got to teach somebody, like, mentally, if they are in an area where they haven't evolved, like, emotionally and mentally and socially, then you want to be able to teach them. And as we talked about Jesus turning over the money tables, it's like he was going to make change for that. And, like, sometimes that turning over that table might be in another space where somebody got to hear what needs to be said, and we got to give them that truth. I feel several ways about it, but overall, I feel like it's our duty to do it. And we, when we have that ability, we should make the effort to do it.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's why. I mean, for me, when I say bear witness, it includes that particular element, right? If people ask you for clarification, they ask you for better understanding, discernment, you say, well, in a humble manner, this is how I understand it, and I think this is the case, you know.
Right.
So in that sense, it has a certain kind of quasi crypto canvas like quality to it.
Quasi crypto style canvas about it. That's Cornell's way of saying he ain't gonna canvas, but he's gonna be next door to canvassing.
I'm gonna be open to anybody whosoever will.
I see what you're saying, but I mean, this is why we call it the tightrope comment. Because, you know, it is a struggle out here to figure out what are the right strategies, and are they always right, and are they always right for everybody? And the answer is no. But there are some things we want to stay on that rope about.
Yes.
And so it's really that continuity and that contradiction that, you know, it's not always easy. And I mean, I take a different, slightly different path than Cornell because of my own predilections, but we're all on the same page.
Yes, and I'm on the rope with y'all, and though I love what you all are doing, I love what you all have done in life. I just want to say I'm honored, like, to be able to build with you guys and to listen. And Dr. West, for as long as I've known your name and received your information, and like, and heard you speak and just been around you, it's always inspiring and enlightening. And Trisha, just to get to build with you and the times I've been able to hear you and get to know you and listen to your wisdom, it's like, man, we need this in on the planet. You know, I'm just grateful that you all are out here doing this. I'm grateful to be on the tightrope. I'm walking that tightrope with you. And then, like you're saying, sometimes I might be over here. You might be over there. Trisha might be over there. But we all on the same path, you know.
Absolutely.
And I thank God for that.
I mean, the beautiful Amen. Thing is no unanimity, no cheap unity. We're raising our voices in a distinctive way. But as long as we somewhere on that love train, sometimes I'm in the caboose, you know what I mean? But I'm on that train, God dang, I'm
on
staying
that train.
On. Yeah, yeah, I'm in the dining car at happy hour right now.
Yes.
Man, well, Common, it's been such an honor and such a blessing, so uplifting. We're really grateful that you come. You know, you're welcome back anytime. We don't need any reason whatsoever to have you, except you want to be on the tightrope.
Well, I would love to be on again. I love getting to talk with you all. Like, it's been fun. It's been amazing and been enlightening. So I'll be there, man. I'm gonna send prayers for y'all and just keep doing what you're doing.
You do the same. We got prayers for you.
We are saluting your genius and your witness, brother. Well, as you all can see, Sister Trisha and I were overjoyed to have Brother Common on the tightrope. In fact, the conversation was so rich, it got so deep, it became a kind of love fest, and it went on much longer than we expected. The brother was so gracious, so gracious, I want to say. He's just so generous. He got love flowing all out of him. And he was gifting us with time and more time. So we decided to pay it forward and gift our Patreon community with some beats with a holiday treat. So we're sharing part two of the common conversation on our channel at patreon.com/thetightropepod. We invite you to subscribe to our Patreon community today. We want you as part of that community. We're going to unlock the extended episode along with lots of other empowering exclusive content. And you get a chance to see behind the scenes footage, what's going on beneath the surface. But before you go, here's a short clip of that extra footage for your viewing pleasure.
That too much of commercial mainstream hip hop, and you know, Common, I've been writing and arguing about hip hop for a very long time, defending it for decades, starting whole fields in academia to support it, but also being very critical of what I think has often, not entirely, but often happened in commercial hip hop, right? Where the worst of what we've been asked to survive has become the source of our identity too much, right? Yes. And so I worry about not only, you know, when I say the pressures you might be under, I worry about the way that market is pressuring young people, people who didn't have Mahalia, people who didn't have your dad, people who may be in other circumstances, and are really, in a sense, becoming, seeing their success only in terms of these kinds of market images and demands. So how do you manage that reality around hip hop? Because you're still such a, you know, you're a statesman in the art form. What is your answer? What do you tell people? How do you help young people see that, but not sort of, you know, become overly invested in it and still love hip hop at the same time?
Well, I mean, I definitely approach him with love, and that love is coming in a form of truth. I don't like hold punches, but I also try to, you know, listen to them. You know, one of the things that we talk about, whether it's young people or whatever, people that ain't even like you or people that may be saying things, I do my best to listen. So when I come back and say something, yeah, or if I need to say something and I'm saying something, I've heard you. And I mean, a lot of times, you know, even a young artist, just some of them was like feeling like the artist from my generation just wasn't even looking to hear them. So I first had to come to a place of where I can be understanding. That don't mean that I'm not going to tell them my truth about what I feel about the art and what they're doing. But I also want to provide solutions. As you said earlier, Trisha, we don't just talk about situations. We look and give solutions too. So, you know, some of my solutions for them, for the younger artists to deal with that pressure, or that maybe just be like part of a factory line of sounding like everybody else's, start creatively. Is this something that you love to do? Do you love hip hop culture? Do you love music? Mm-hmm. Because if you're just doing it for the money, it's gonna fade off at some point, and that's why your art is not what it is. Or if you're just doing it just to get out of the ghetto, I understand it. We all want, I want you out of the ghetto. That's part of my mission. But it may not be through this art, or this may be a simple way for you to get access to other things. But to think that you're gonna have a career and you don't have a love for it, or a real true gift or talent, or are not willing to work or study, that is not gonna usually be long withstanding. It's not gonna be.
Wow, Cornell, was that amazing or what?
Oh, I'm telling you, boy, he's a special brother, and what a high quality, sincere, candid dialogue we had.
That was rich and beautiful. Mm. And you know, we had a lot to consider. We was on the tightrope today.
We were on the tightrope in a mighty way. And as we come to the end of the year, we couldn't come to the end on a higher note than Brother Common and all that's wisdom.
Exactly. Keep us reminding of what we need to be doing.
Absolutely. You know? Absolutely.
Yes, well, it's time for us to check on out. You know, we've been on this rope a little longer today. And we want to thank everybody for joining us. We're so grateful for you to check us out and to share us on social media and to watch us on YouTube. And we try to keep up with all of your comments. Thank you so much for being part of the Tightrope community. And thank you, Cornel West, for being a dear friend. And I wouldn't be on the tightrope with anybody else. Take care, everybody.
It's a blessing to be here with you, my dear sister.